Word of mouth. Word of mouth. Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, the new dogs of war. After decades off the battlefield, canines are being recruited and trained to be highly specialized warriors. We'll also listen to the Mexo-American roots rocker David Wax of the band David Wax Museum. But first, the right generally gets the rap for being anti-science. The language of political partisanship holds the right up as creationists and climate change deniers who oppose stem cell research. This same dyad holds up the left as pro-science. These are the progressives who project a love of science, defend data-driven inquiry, and even hold difficult truths in a rational embrace. That's bunk, says Alex Barrazeau and Hank Campbell. Together, they challenge the left's label as the pro-science party in a new book called Science Left Behind, Feel-Good Fallacies and the Rise of the Anti-Scientific Left. One of the authors, Alex Barrazeau, joins us now from KUOW in Seattle. He has a PhD in microbiology and is editor of Real Clear Science. Alex, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on.
Early in the program, you point out the instant credibility problem of any book that deals with politics. We assume a book about fallacies held by the left must be agenda-driven. Now, how do you describe yourself politically?
Well, I see myself first and foremost as someone who thinks that science should take primacy over politics. And so I don't have any particular problem with calling out either conservatives or progressives or liberals or libertarians whenever they get a scientific issue wrong. And so that's kind of how I see myself. I see myself more as a combatant for Team Science rather than for Team Blue or Team Red.
Real target here is progressives, however. How do you distinguish liberals and progressives?
Well, we talk about this early on in the book, and we basically make a separation based on social authoritarianism. So whereas liberals seem to be more interested in economic outcomes, for example, if you think a typical liberal might be a unionized police officer from New York City, for instance, whereas we see progressives as having more of a social agenda as well. So whereas conservatives are more interested in issues like sexuality and drugs, progressives are more interested in telling you how much salt you can put in your food and whether or not you can have a plastic bag in your house.
At the center of this idea is that progressives have their own sacred cows that they do not want challenged, and that their unscientific claims or support for anti-scientific policies are less likely to be scrutinized. Give us some examples of this.
For instance, this just happened recently. The California Democratic Party endorsed Proposition 37, which is a movement to label genetically modified foods. Now, genetically modified foods are supported by every major scientific organization in America, ranging from the National Academy of Sciences to world organizations such as the World Health Organization, the United Nations. Everyone seems to recognize the importance of genetic modification, and yet the Democratic Party supports labeling these foods as if they are somehow dangerous. Now, interestingly, the American Medical Association took the opposite stance. They said that is not something we should be doing because it will confuse customers and it will confuse shoppers. And the Democratic Party went against the advice of the American Medical Association, yet the Republicans took their side.
Well, as far as food safety is concerned, in Europe, for example, there's anti-GMO regulation in many European countries, and the entire EU bans growth hormones in milk, which is something that you address in the book. Now, is the entire union seized by this kind of anti-science fervor?
The European Union? Exactly. Is that what you're asking?
You know, it seems to be in a way that Europeans seem to have an aversion to biotechnology in a way that Americans do not.
And that's not coming from me. That's coming from the new appointment, the EU science advisor. Her name is Dr. Anne Glover, who she happens to be a microbiologist, just like me. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm a little partial. But she, in an interview with Science, the journal Science, said that Europe seems to have an aversion to biotechnology, particularly genetic modification. And one of the things that is enshrined in the European Union's constitution is the idea of the precautionary principle, which basically states that we should not release anything publicly until we know for certain that it's safe. And that's a problem from a scientific standpoint, because you can never prove something to be safe. You can show something that's unsafe, but you can never prove something to be safe. That sets an impossible standard for scientists to actually achieve. And therefore, because you can never prove it, it becomes very difficult to put new technologies on the market.
the opposition to vaccination has been pretty well covered. We spoke with Seth Mnookin about his book about it. Mm-hmm. One of the big things to come out of that is that science and other journalists are falling down on the job. So how does the media fit in? What are we failing to do in science reporting, and what can we do to make it better?
You know, I think that having more scientific expertise in the newsroom would be a good first step. A lot of journalists seem to think that it's necessary to have a balance. Well, we need to have one scientist that says this, and we have another scientist that says the opposite. But that's not how things usually work in science. Usually in science, there's one predominant viewpoint which is more supported by the evidence than the other. And I think having scientifically minded people in the newsroom who can kind of figure that out and to ferret out what's the good science from what's the bad science would be a good first step towards fixing that problem.
Most of the things that are raised in the book is really the stuff of great, serious scientific discussion. But it was released in this political season. Now, will that help to depoliticize science, releasing a book like this at this time?
Well, we try to take some of the politics out of it by not making it about Republicans and Democrats. We're trying to say that this problem is more of a way of thinking. It's, you know, fastening on to certain myths that seem to associate themselves with the progressive movement. For example, the idea that natural things are better, or that unnatural things are bad for you, or that unchecked science is somehow destructive, that, you know, science and technology will destroy the planet if we don't keep it in check. We try to tackle these ideas from more of a how do people think ideologically rather than how do people think in a partisan Democrat versus Republican way.
Is there any issue where the most scientifically accurate viewpoint lies somewhere in between the policies of, let's just go with that dyad again, of the two parties currently?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think there is a lot of room for negotiation on energy policy, to be honest. I think that even though a lot of conservatives don't see a problem with global warming, they do see a problem with importing oil, for instance, from the Middle East. They don't like that. So if you can bring them on board by saying, okay, well, this isn't about global warming, it's about getting off of dictator oil, they might be more on board with that sort of a strategy. And similarly, if you could pitch the same sort of idea to the left side of the spectrum, saying, look, you know, wind and solar are great, and we want to develop those policies, but until then, we might have to rely on natural gas and nuclear power until we get the gold standard, which would be solar power.
Alex Barrazzo, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Alex Barrazzo, he has a PhD in microbiology, and he's editor of Real Clear Science and co-author of the book Science Left Behind, Feel Good Fallacies and the Rise of the Anti-Scientific Left. We'd love to hear what you think. Are you sticking with organics despite that Stanford study that says you're not really doing anything but paying more for vegetables? Do you think there's an anti-scientific stance in politics that's more egregious than the rest? Or do you find the scientific community possesses just as much rhetoric as the rest of us? Tell us what you think on Facebook, Twitter, or email your thoughts to wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Last month, Twitter launched its Political Index, a daily measurement of feelings about candidates for office drawn from nearly 2 million tweets each week. So far, the index is running parallel with Gallup polls. A number of political junkies are way ahead of the index. They're pretty clear on how novelist Eleanor Lipman feels. She's been tweeting daily political poems since April. Here's one from earlier this week. It's all he has besides his truck, a broken record, needle stuck. Scott Brown wishes he could be at least a quarter Cherokee. Lipman is author of 9 novels and a new book of humor called Tweetland of Liberty. It's a collection of irreverent rhymes from her Twitter handle, @Eleanor Lipman. Eleanor, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Virginia.
So you're not a Scott Brown fan, I get it.
Well, you know, I'm an unapologetic Democrat, so really,
Well, you know, I was thinking you're pretty much made for this medium, Eleanor. The spelling of your name has no E-A in it, and you have only one P in Lipman, so those are 3 full characters you can save when being retweeted. It's a pretty lucky thing.
Oh, you know, you are the first person to point that out, and I didn't think of it.
But you're kind of a convert to Twitter. You sort of poo-pooed the social media site. Now you're an avid user. So what happened?
you know, I went to a panel at a writer's conference, and not even because I wanted to learn more about social networking, but the people on the panel were my friends, so I was just going there to be collegial. You know, I came away convinced, and a lot of it has to do with I write novels, and it's good for your career, supposedly, and good for your fanhood. So I came home, and I wrote just a straight tweet about the day I came home, New York passed gay marriage. Mm-hmm. So I wrote about that, and the next morning I thought, well, you know, who's going to be interested in me just putting a megaphone to my inner thoughts? So I said, I know, I love poetry, I love rhyming, and I'm a political junkie. So I made this foolish pledge 7 days a week. From then, June 24th or something like that, 2011, till the election, to write a poem a day.
Oh, my goodness. So that's a lot. How many have you done so far? Have you counted?
Today's something like my 457th.
Oh, my goodness. But you even do this on weekends. Have you missed any days at all?
I took off Yom Kippur. A total it'll be 499 days. And secretly, I'm not even that observant.
Well, tell me, do you have either favorite examples or a couple of recent examples you'd like to read for us?
I do. Let's see. Well, you know, early on, I had the benefit of all the candidates, all the Republicans,
in
the primary. So this was just about the time, this was about the last gasp of Newt Gingrich. So it was bit by penguin at the zoo. What's a candidate to do? Soon the bird wrote in his blog, Newt tastes like an underdog.
Okay, more.
Oh, okay. This was Santorum, oddly enough, rhymed with more things than I thought. Yeah. I once rhymed Santorum with Purim, and that turned out to be very popular. But this was some Midwestern state primary. It wasn't up Santorum's alley, two men smooching at a rally. You've made your point, now go away. Only Democrats are gay.
Why not do more non-political or non-partisan commentary? Well, you'd probably get a much larger audience, Eleanor.
I know. What can I say? I think that, in a way, it's kind of giving Republicans a lot of attention, wasn't it? Mm. You know, every day, and it was either Kane or Bachman. And, you know, Kane and Gingrich were really, like, the gifts that kept on giving. And so I did, on occasion, especially on the first 9/11 that came along, was the 10th anniversary, and that was a solemn, nonpartisan tweet. And occasionally, if something was in the headlines, I felt it would be clueless to not tweet about that.
To your knowledge, is there any conservative Eleanor Lipman tweeting jokes about the Democratic Party?
You know, I hope so, she says insincerely. I haven't heard from them yet. I've been told I'm only the only one doing this, and I didn't start with some kind of goal like that, like, oh, I want to be unique. It was just this impulse. I've written, you know, some friends' birthdays, 40th birthday poem. I did 4 years ago, I wrote a long poem that was a tribute to Michelle Obama's wardrobe, and that was at an Obama fundraiser, truth be told. And so, yeah.
Thank you so much, Eleanor.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Eleanor Lipman is the author of 9 novels and a new collection of political rhymes called Tweetland of Liberty. You could find a link to read more of them at wordofmouthradio.org. Have you got a favorite conservative pundit poking fun at the left on Twitter, Facebook, some other medium of influence? Let us know who they are. Or if you're up for a challenge, construct your own political rhyme, partisan or otherwise, and send it along to Word of Mouth on Twitter, post it on our Facebook page, or email us, wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Coming up, we'll listen in on a yoga class where students learn the benefits of laughter. We'll cue the laugh track when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Now for a little nonpartisan salve, the infectious and non-discriminating power of laughter. That's the sound of 250 people practicing laughter yoga at a Mumbai club. There are now about 8,000 laughter yoga clubs in 65 countries. We asked our most solemn producer, Sean Hurley, to visit a club here in Concord, New Hampshire, to see if he could make himself laugh at nothing.
Of all the creatures of the earth, including the ferns and the crocodiles, only we people get the joke. A pie to the face, anything with a cat. We laugh. We get it. And scientists don't really know why. Marcia Wyman, who runs the Laughter Yoga Club in Concord, has become a kind of minister of silliness.
Children laugh between 300 and 500 times a day, and we adults laugh 15 times on the average per day. We laugh small, and we do it because something outside of ourselves has made us laugh.
Most often, we're not laughing at jokes, but just flowing with the tide of social discourse. Laughter in the absence of anything humorous is a form of bonding. Social glue, the social glue experts call it. Marcia Wyman would also call laughter a kind of medicine. In 2010, the former national archery champion suffered a debilitating stroke. Physical therapy and pills weren't helping.
I was paralyzed on the left side. I was looking for something to inspire me, and I watched a documentary on laughter yoga, and I thought, what a nice thing to do, to laugh for the rest of my life, thinking that I'd be paralyzed half my body for the rest of my life.
Marcia asked a friend to drive her to a laughter yoga training in Massachusetts.
We laughed for a whole weekend. I could immediately feel the benefits of it, tingly sensations, awareness, fullness, and I would say half a year, maybe a little bit more, I regained the use of my arm and my leg and everything else.
Marcia now leads 3 laughter yoga sessions a week. When I arrive for my first ever class, Marcia gives me a mildly disquieting overview.
The whole process of laughter yoga is to laugh without jokes, without comedy, without humor.
And so how does somebody, you know, for example, me, how would I mean, am I fake laughing, or what am I?
Yeah, they've done scientific studies that fake laughter also kicks in the endorphins and the serotonins, that your body doesn't know the difference between real laughter and fake laughter.
My body doesn't, but I certainly do. Some say the fake yawn is the hardest of the involuntary breechments. Some will point to the fake sneeze as being the more vexing rabbit to pull from the body's hat. But for me, the most uncomfortable bit of Foley is the fake laugh.
Ha ha ha. Oh my gosh.
Hello, cheesy wax mustache black and white movie villain from days of yore. Marcia gives me a laughter yoga mantra to repeat to myself. Fake it till you make it. There are about 20 of us in the unfunnily fluorescent meeting room. As class begins, I find my wax mustache villain turning, without promise, into a damp and nervous robot.
So in this particular program, we laugh loud. We're going to start the exercise by 1, 2, 3, start, so that we can all do them. And when we do them, we wander around the room and look people in the eye, because laughter is very contagious. And when you're laughing, somebody else laughs. And then to stop, I'm going to do very good, very good, yay. And you can join me. We'll do it 3 times. Very good, yay. Very good, yay.
We pat our legs. We pull invisible string through our heads. We imagine unpleasant things on our shoes. There isn't really any obvious yoga. There's no postures, but there's a lot of breathing and movement. And we do the vowels. We do this sort of discovery one, like we've found something important, and also have to sneeze. And then we just laugh for the no good reason heck of it.
You know, people arrive apprehensive, not quite sure what's going to happen. Some people sort of a chip on their shoulder, like, try to make me laugh, you know, go ahead. And because there's emotion in motion, and we do a lot of motion and a lot of play acting and a lot of movement, it just melts away. It's
It just disappears. It's nice.
Why we laugh may be a mystery, but the effects are increasingly clear. 10 minutes of laughter drops blood pressure and improves digestion. Stress dissolves. Best of all for me, every damp robot and wax mustache villain character combination inside me gets turned, pretty quickly, into a simple child at play. You can fake it till you make it, which really is very good, very good. Yay. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
They all laughed at Christopher Columbus when he said the world was round.
For more on laughter yoga, including a video showing how it's done, go to wordofmouthradio.org. And coming up, the new Dogs of War, a training program that's engineering the next generation of canine warrior companions. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
They told Marconi, wireless was a phony. It's the same old cry. They laugh at me, warning you. Said I was reaching for the moon. But oh, you came.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 Word of mouth. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now to next-gen war dogs. The Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans employed war dogs as sentries and patrols and sometimes took them into battle. Attila the Hun bred giant Molosser dogs to rout out invaders. Spanish conquistadors trained armored dogs to kill and disembowel their enemies. And dogs, first used by the American military during the Seminole Wars, also aided soldiers from the Civil War up until Vietnam. Though absent from the battlefield for decades, bomb-sniffing dogs were reintroduced in 2007. And like the weaponry deployed today, the training and capabilities of canines is now so specialized and so sophisticated that our guest Sharon Weinberger referred to one recruit as the Jason Bourne of dogs. Sharon is a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center and a columnist for BBC Future. Sharon, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
What did war dogs do in Vietnam and why were they not used for so many years afterwards?
Well, what happened was basically after the Vietnam War, there wasn't really an immediate necessity for deployed dogs, meaning having dogs actually out on the battlefield. And so the Air Force essentially took them over. And what we had after Vietnam was the Air Force was using these dogs to patrol missile fields, basically, you know, these large stretches of land out in Wyoming. So they're really used more for security purposes. But decades went by and there really wasn't a need. You know, you didn't have sort of the problem of IEDs for many decades or bombs that you had in Vietnam. So we didn't have sort of a cadre of trained bomb dogs for the battlefield.
So now they brought them back to the battlefield. Are they being used strictly for bomb sniffing or actively aid in combat?
No, we have them being used sort of across the realm for different purposes. Sort of most famously, what we're hearing about now is Navy SEALs used a dog Cairo in the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. That's a little bit more. There's only a little bit known about that program. These dogs are used both for sniffing bombs, but they're also used for tracking insurgents. But there's another tangent to that, which is, you know, most parts of the military, they don't need a dog that's aggressive and can go, you know, track people down. What they need on the battlefield right now for a good part of the military is something simply that can find improvised explosive devices. So what happened was, is the Office of Naval Research said, well, you know, everyone thinks they know what makes for a good dog, a good working dog, but no one's actually done a scientific program to sort of breed and choose the best dog. So let's turn it into a science program.
So that's what they're doing in North Carolina, where you talk to trainers and where hunting dogs have been a long tradition. They're now currently developing IED detector dog 2.0, I guess. So what does that training entail and where do they do it and how?
Well, what it is so back in 2007, there was sort of the 1.0 where they said, well, we think we know what we want. We want a good-natured dog, and that's why they use Black Labs, because they're very good-natured dogs. They're very easy to work with. And then over the past 5 years, they've been developing this 2.0, a science program, which entails a host of things, you know, looking at the nutrition of dogs on the battlefield, looking at screening dogs. You know, not all dogs are the same. Some have sort of very good cognitive skills. Some have good spatial awareness. Some dogs are more bold than others. others. Some are more afraid. You probably don't want sort of a really, really scared dog out on the battlefield. And so they're looking across all of these factors, you know, cognitive reading, spatial awareness, boldness, and then natural sort of smelling abilities to select the best dog.
How does a trainer or a scientist come up with understanding a dog's cognitive ability and moving it forward in a way that they can sort of harness for battlefield experiments?
Well, you kind of do it the same way that we do it for students in school. You know, we have the SATs, which is a test that is a decent indicator of how students are going to do in college. It's not perfect. Nothing is perfect. But, you know, you develop tests that test skill sets and sort of make predictions. So what they're trying to do is do the same thing for dogs. So some of the tests seem very basic. For instance, they'll have dogs go up and down a sort of like wrought iron stairs, mm-hmm. stairs that you can see through. This is very disturbing for a lot of dogs. Dogs don't like to climb on things that you can see through. It doesn't give them that sense of stability they like. So that's a very simple example of a screening test. Another thing they might do is, you know, they have a dog in a lab room. You know, they pipe in a, you know, the sound of a gunshot or an explosion, and they get a sense of looking at how does the dog react to that? Are they calm? Does it make them uptight or nervous? And so it's a series of tests like these that try to determine, you know, is that dog a good candidate for deploying to the battlefield?
We're speaking about the next generation of U.S. military dogs with Sharon Weinberger. She's a columnist for BBC Future and author of the book Imaginary Weapons. Well, battlefield technology, of course, is so sophisticated now. How are these dogs outfitted? Do they have cameras? Do they have lasers? Anything that helps communicate back to the people who are at command and control?
Well, the interesting thing is there are military dogs that are equipped with things like cameras or radio devices or things that, you know, sort of the trainers can communicate with them. These dogs, when they're actually deployed, aren't, and that's specifically what the Marines wanted. When they're in training, they wear things like, you know, they're developing telemetry vests for them because there's interesting scientific questions. You know, when a dog catches a smell, whether it's, you know, fertilizer that's going to be used in a bomb or whether it's a, you know, hunting for someone, there's obviously something that happens in sort of its neural network and its body. And so these scientists down in North Carolina are looking, you know, does the breathing rate change? Does the heart rate change? But that's a science experiment. When the dogs actually go to the field, what the Marines specifically said is, you know, we have so much equipment already. We will take a dog if a dog helps us, but the last thing we want is a dog that comes with all this equipment. So, in fact, these dogs that are being deployed, they're called off-leash dogs, meaning that they can operate off a leash, and that's the way they're trained, that, you know, you don't need a trainer going up and sniffing them around. You know, you can take the dog off the leash, it goes around, it sniffs, and tries to find whether there's a bomb in the vicinity.
Hmm. You mentioned that dogs are screened for some of their cognitive skills, and I would imagine also susceptible to trauma. I mean, how do trainers deal with the psychological needs, if you will, of military dogs? And is there any concern from animal rights groups about the effect that battlefield situations could have on them?
Well, there's two different things going on. One that you've probably seen in the news is there have been some reports that dogs on the battlefield could suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder the same as humans.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, from sort of a biological standpoint, that makes perfect sense. I mean, what we're learning now about PTSD in humans is that there's actual changes in the brain when you are sort of exposed to repeated traumatic events. And so if that change to the brain happens in humans, there's no reason it wouldn't happen in dogs. So from the scientific program, that is one of the things they're screening for. You know, you want, just like in soldiers, you want resilience. You hope that soldiers are able to sort of rebound from these things. You want the same thing from dogs. When it comes to animal rights groups, I really haven't seen any animal rights groups really objecting to this, in part because, you know, there's a tremendous amount of support for these programs. You know, military dogs are treated, I mean, they get the best medical care. You know, when they retire, that there is no lack of people in the military, retired military, adopting them. In fact, for these dogs, the Office of Naval Research dogs that they've been training, they usually go to former dog trainers when they retire. And I think there's a recognition from animal rights groups that if you want sort of the public to support rights of dogs, part of it is people recognizing the important role that dogs play as service dogs in society and with the military. So I haven't really seen any objections to it.
How about the personal connection with the soldiers? Do they feel themselves bonding with dogs on an emotional level?
I think so. I mean, speaking specifically about the naval program that I looked at, one of the things that the head of the program, Lisa Albuquerque, mentioned to me was at the beginning, you know, Marines really weren't that supportive. They're like, well, you know, really, how helpful are dogs going to be? They didn't want a pet on the battlefield. But as the dogs began to find IEDs, as they began to prove their worth, there was this tremendous bond that developed between the Marines and the dogs. You know, the Marines were offering to carry water and provisions for the dogs. You know, Marines don't usually volunteer to carry anything more than they have to. And in fact, now there's this tradition that they name the dogs, the deployed dogs with the Marines, after fallen Marines, after Marines that might have died in IED attacks. So there has been this real bond that's developed.
More being revealed there. Sharon Weinberger, I really want to thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Sharon Weinberger is a columnist for BBC Future. She's also author of the book Imaginary Weapons, and there is a link to read her article, Upgrading the Dogs of War, at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, Mexo-American roots rocker David Wax of the band David Wax Museum. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. As a band, David Wax Museum is a kind of a palate cleanser. Take some Mexican folk songs, run them through an indie pop bath, maybe add a dash of donkey's jawbone, and you've got a musical breath of fresh air.
When we were young and in love, the nights couldn't last long enough.
Songs like this one, Rumors Are True, from David Wax Museum's new album, Knock Knock Get Up, have a kind of brightness that you might not expect from an album produced in a drafty farmhouse in the bracing cold of a New England winter. We caught up with David Wax at New England Public Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts, to talk about the new record. I'd watched a video of David, his musical partner Sue Slezak, and other musicians working on the album in that farmhouse in Parsonfield, Maine. I asked him why they chose to record it there, of all places.
Our producer, Sam Kassir, who tours and produces the records of Josh Ritter, produced our last record, and we had so much fun making that record that we were just sure that we were going to go back up there to do this one. He's created this incredible studio space in rural Maine where you just have to be focused on the record. There's no other thing you could possibly
do. But there is a kind of bright energy on this record. I mean, I'm not talking about Beach Boys, but, you know, certainly not Sigur Rós, but a sound that you and Suze Slezak have sort of made your own in a way. How do you maintain that brightness when you're looking at a cold, leafless trees every single day?
So many of the songs were conceived down in Mexico. And Suze had compiled a bunch of different field recordings from our time in Mexico that kind of found their way interspersed into the record. And a lot of the inspiration for these songs come from traditional Mexican folk music. So inevitably, there's going to be that brightness and that exuberance that comes from kind of drawing from those roots.
That's something that you and Sue Slezak have kind of made your own, this celebration of, the Mexican son, which kind of stamped your sound. I'm going to play an example here. This is off of David Wax Museum's first album, I Turned Off Thinking About. The song is called There Was a Bridge. Wow, that's a big difference.
Oh man, you're going to the deep catalog.
We're going
there.
To the deep catalog. We wanted to really compare it because
New Hampshire Public Radio.
Well, you know, we always go for the deep cuts. We could surprise you. there's not, as you say, a lot of other things to distract us. Let's put it that way. But tell us, what characterizes the Mexican son? I mean, we have the Cuban son, and tell us, give us the definition that you work with.
Mexican son is actually very broad. Regionally, there are about 9 different styles. So when you start generalizing, you talk about kind of where it comes from, which is all these styles are some confluence of African, indigenous, and Spanish coming together. Mm. A lot of people aren't familiar with the African influence in Mexico, but there were lots of Africans brought over and enslaved on the sugar plantations and in the mines in Mexico. So there's a strong African current here. But then you also have the melding of the Spanish traditions and the indigenous traditions that were there. So it's dance music done on a raised wooden platform, and it's kind of a clogging style of dance. And that's a real central element of the percussion of this music.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
And it's done in, this is community folk music. This is music that's an integral part of life in Mexico and still in many parts of Mexico.
So how did you, a young man from Missouri, discover this?
Well, I was actually down in Mexico the summer after my freshman year of college. I got involved with the American Friends Service Committee doing rural development work in La Huasteca region, which is about 8 hours north of Mexico City. And I found myself down there living in a rural indigenous community, and people were playing this style of music, son huasteco. It hit me. I never thought I would actually learn how to play it, but I started dancing and just found it as an incredible way to kind of enter into life down there. And, man, one thing led to another, and I kept finding myself back down there in Mexico. And I ended up studying Latin American history and literature at Harvard. And when I graduated from Harvard, I applied and got a postgraduate fellowship to go back down to Mexico to live there for a year, to spend a whole year delving into to learning Mexican folk music.
Well, so you went in deep. Let's hear Leopard Girl. Now, this is Now for Something Completely Different, the first song off the new album Made in the Maine Woods.
I want you to paint me. Pick up your easel and your brush. Not well versed in art, but I know this much. Paint me holding something. Maybe a rose or a rosary. You'll bring out the death in my face. Or show me younger than you know me to be. Why won't everything but collide.
That's Leopard Girl, not the first song, but from the new album Knock Knock Get Up by David Wax Museum. I'm speaking with David Wax right now. You know, we're not the only one who noticed the difference, David. Reviews of the album note significant departures from previous albums. I'm wondering if that was a, I don't know, conscious evolution, natural, just ready for a change?
I think it's been a pretty natural evolution for us. I mean, I think with each record, there's been a clear sense that when the project gets very interesting, it's when we're starting to kind of blend these two influences of the Mexican and the American. And the more that we kind of blur that line, that's where things get very exciting and where we start coming into new terrain where the kind of assumptions we've worked with don't make sense anymore, and we have to kind of come up with new ways of thinking about the music.
Funny you said blurring, that sort of distortion and the fuzzy guitar in that one, but the Mexican line.
Yeah, and there's kind of that, that song we just were listening to, the kind of the rhythm guitar is a huge Mexican guitar called a huapanguera, which comes from the Huasteca region. And then there are kind of breaks in that song where it goes into kind of a mariachi kind of 6-8 feel, and this kind of group singing that comes up later that's from Mexico. So sometimes it's, thinking about, okay, we've got a song that's kind of pretty straightforward American song, but what can we do with the instrumentation? What can we do with a moment in the song where it goes to a different place? And I think we've just found that that's a more interesting place to work, to kind of see that it's not that interesting when it's just the songs that are kind of translations of the Mexican songs and then the straight-ahead Americana songs. But when we kind of bridge that difference, that's when we kind of get that buzzy feeling in the studio and feeling like we're doing something exciting.
Yeah, and that energy, I guess, characterizes who you are. I mean, you're known for your energetic live shows. I've actually seen you live, but I was reading a review earlier, someone talking about they were playing on stage, they were playing in the crowd, they were playing on top of the bar. They did everything but jump behind the bar and make me a drink. So do you think about that when you're producing records? How are we going to play this live?
Oh, we do. I mean, it's a daunting feeling because we're a four-piece band right now on the road, and we had time to do lots and lots of layers on this record. But I think that when you're on stage, you have different tricks you can pull out, different kinds of energy levels and way of connecting with the crowd that you can't do in the studio. And so you have to kind of realize that they're very separate enterprises in a way.
Let's hear more from the album. It came out just a few weeks ago. It's called Knock Knock Get Up, which most critics do say is your best work to date. This song is called Harder Before It Gets Easier.
You've been sobbing so hard you can barely breathe. You've been sobbing so hard you can barely breathe. You've been stitching your heart on the outside of your sleeve. You've been stitching your heart on the outside of your sleeve. You've been wrung out and in doubt with grief. And the ocean of time is falling. We'll be brief, we'll be brief. Oh, I know it's gonna get harder before it gets easier. Unprepared. Knock, knock, baby, it does not care.
Harder Before It Gets Easier. That's from the new album Knock Knock Get Up by David Wax Museum. David Wax is with me. He's pretty much half of the band, but I guess on other days, one-sixth of the band, one-fifth of the band. Many people playing together. Again, that Mexican influence still present, even though there's a lot of other sounds there, and I'm wondering if that will always be the backbone or I guess maybe I should say jawbone in your case, because you play jawbone in your band of David Wax Museum.
Yeah, Suze does play the jawbone.
Yeah, how does she play it? Just explain it to listeners who haven't seen such a thing.
Sure. Well, it's a traditional percussion instrument from southern Veracruz, Mexico, and it is what it sounds like. It's actually the jawbone of a donkey, and she has a stick, and she scrapes it against the teeth of the jawbone, and then with the side of her hand, she'll hit the bottom of the jaw, and all the teeth will shake and rattle in there and bump up against each other, and so it makes this really organic, rattling sound.
It's really something to witness, and we do have some videos online of David Wax Museum. But before we go, I wanted to ask you about, you went to China last year, the band did, as a cultural ambassador for the United States. That's quite a lofty title. How did the Chinese like your music?
Well, they were surprisingly into it. I mean, we didn't know what to expect at all, but they were just so open to being moved by the music. And I think that's even sometimes hard with an American audience, to people to really be kind of open to letting the music take them somewhere to a real emotional experience. And I found that the audiences there were in a way more primed for that. I mean, we couldn't believe that we were there. But,
yeah, so you're joining the diplomatic corps now as a cultural ambassador. I want to thank you for your time, David.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
David Wax there from David Wax Museum. The band is playing tonight at the Stone Church in Newmarket, New Hampshire. For more on the band, tour dates, and the new album, Knock Knock Get Up, including the video about the making of the album in Maine, click on over to wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for spending some time with the program today. Do join us next week for more unexpected conversations and stories to pique your curiosity. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
With web support from Sarah Plore.
Andrew Perella, that's me,
provides technical support.
And Dan Kogan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR.
Its board of trustees or its underwriters.
That's right.
For information about the show, to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment, or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Cool.
Thank you.
All day, take care of everything.